I want to, as all before me, to thank Jen for the opportunity to be here and to be challenged by the many issues and ideas and conceptions that are being presented from the area of the gift economy to its concrete expression throughout history and society. For someone like me, whose time is spent in the practical terms of the construction of social movements, for the creation of a world in which institutions will support the development of the human potential by protecting, promoting, defending, and practicing that all human beings are equal in rights and in dignity. For someone who spends most of the time here looking and spending a few days reflecting on the different theoretical constructs of how we interpret that practice is an important part of what long-term activists have known as a relationship between theory and practice. And others before me have spent much time thinking about what that relationship is. And certainly, as a norm that guides my political work and the work that we do in the construction of these movements, is that there is a relationship between theory and practice. Theory gives us direction, and practice gives us the movement. And it is the learning from theory that enables us to actually move these movements in their construction and in their development in a way that will benefit people. But it also, the practice, when you look at it, retroalimenta in Spanish, or gives back and feeds theoretical development. So for me, it was interesting that to look at the immigrant rights movement, to look at the human rights movement, to look at the communities where I work, and to try to understand what this theory of a gift economy is in its practical expression. And certainly one of the most important aspects of the restructuring and integration of the global economy right now is the role of the human right to mobility. And this role is an important part because it talks about how this economy is being integrated. It is about the interdependence of social, economic, and political relationships in the human family. And so human mobility in the current phase, being restructured by economic and political elites worldwide, conditions the way people live within countries as well as those that attempt to move across countries. The wealth created has enabled more than ever before in human history, the technology, the communications, and the ability to move easily across borders, a historical experience recreated within the configuration of civilizations and countries throughout the globe. But that increased capacity, given the current strategy of economic global development, has made mobility safely and legally across borders a right for only a very few, the global economic and political elites. That mobility is easily seen when we see the movement of CEOs of corporations all over the world, the meeting of political elites without any problem, safely and legally across borders, to also discuss issues of global dominance and exploitation and control, but also of those called refugees, the Marcoses of Philippines, the Salinas de Gortaris of Mexico, and all others who are considered the wealthy refugees. All of these sectors move legally and safely across the world without any problems, so that their role is sustained and maintained in the recreation and construction of this globalization from above. And so when we look at the development of immigration policy in nation states throughout the world, and how these define who is allowed to enter, who is allowed to stay, who is allowed to become a member of the nation state, it becomes very clear that immigration policy and border enforcement policy is about the restriction of mobility of the international working poor and the internationally displaced who are poor. Borders, barriers, border agents, and militarized institutional violence to restrict mobility are part of the mechanisms to reinforce social, political, gender inequalities on a global scale of the very few against the very many. Institutional violence is necessary to sustain these inequities. And so those that must sustain it, like any other type of human activity, will define the movement across the border without government inspection as a crime. A crime that has no violence and has no victim, but that permits the construction of institutions both internally and externally that ensure that the strategy of economic development of those elites persist. And that strategy is of the creation of high profits and low wages. It is a mechanism that also assists in the implementation of the structural adjustment policies of a scorched earth policy that forces a building of havens for speculative capital investment circles while curtailing investments in social infrastructure and in human development. It is a policies that then force millions to opt for the incorporation into a global labor market, their only option for survival. And so the movement of people become an important aspect of challenging the very policies that wants to restrict its conditions according to the plans of increasing profits. So when communities faced with structural adjustment policies of scarcity and families opt to move to another country, these decisions are made by families in consultations of who must migrate and who must stay. They are made in the context of communities that have traditions of moving across international borders and have established networks that both receive them in those countries and who help them to move through the borders and who then help them to sustain the families and communities in the countries of origin. The decision in that sense is a decision made by families to regenerate their survival, forming strong emotional bonds that will respond to the needs, the fundamental basic needs to sustain their development as families and as humans. And yet it is this very act, this timeless transnational networks that operate in the context of exploitation and policies of plundering countries of origin that actually form the networks of resistance and rebellions to the known or design of the powerful economic elites. The family networks facilitate migration. The family networks facilitate reinstatement of community needs, and family networks allow the instant conveying of resources, information, and even affection. It's interesting to note the growth in the use of, for instance, cell phones in communities of origins and receptions. There are even communities who install computers in the community so that families can then see each other from places, for instance, as far as New York, to places in small, tiny villages in the state of Michoacán in Mexico or in Ecuador. So in the current global configuration, the movement of people as a strategy of survival, I have learned from last night's talk, is actually a strategy of thrival. And this strategy of thrival is based on living an economy of giving that sustains economic prosperity and interconnections between people moving north and resources coming south in the midst of an ecosystem and a global configuration that threatens the very sustainability of communities, economies, and particularly the development of human beings. So when I analyzed the phenomena, I said, my God, there is a gift economy in this process of transnationalization of movements, communities. And what is that gift? According to a great deal of interest now by many powerful institutions and studies and surveys, they've been discovered that of the people who live outside of their countries of origin, $100 billion move globally every year between the so-called developed countries and the developing countries due to the money sent back by millions and millions of immigrants worldwide. $30 billion of those dollars go to Latin America, $15 billion, half of that, to Mexico. And then there are many, many unrecorded gifts in resources by communities. It is considered, again, by these surveys that half of the unrecorded and the free labor given to this development has actually outedged net direct foreign investment in countries of origin. As I often propose to Mexican immigrants, we might as well form a co-op and buy Mexico. So what is the gift? The gift is $190 at least sent back to families 7 times per year. In some cases it is 100, in some cases it is 300. In some cases, immigrants will send back 15% of each paycheck, and others will send 50% of each paycheck. So the range is 15 to 15% of salaries in labor markets of exploitation that go back to sustain families. Who receives? Well, let's talk about the senders first. Who sends these? Who are the senders? They tend to be migrants, as I said, selected, agreed to by the consensus of families, to move to seek economic opportunity. They are the socially excluded, who transformed the experience of migrations as an experience of liberation for themselves and for their communities. If we look at Latin America, some 6 million immigrants send money back home on a regular basis. 6 million sent $30 billion. Of these, one half have been in the U.S. for less than 10 years. Who are the senders? There's a national employment survey that was done in Mexico and found out that out of 5,896 individuals who migrated to the United States between 1997 and 2002, 70% had sent money back home. 89% were men, 60% are less than 30 years old, 48% were of homes that also had senders of money, and 79% of these are people who entered the United States without documents. It is considered that two-thirds of the senders have been in the United States less than 10 years, and they send money once a month, When you look at migrants that have been in the United States less than 5 years, 3/4 send once per month. And so when we look at the income range of the senders in the United States, we find that people who earn $50,000 or more a year send 9%. This is they're talking about Mexico. 9% are the ones who send money back home. Of the people who earn $30,000 to $50,000 a year, 32% of these send money back home. And of people who earn less than $30,000, 46% of these send money back home. So in effect, 78% of the $15 billion sent back to Mexico are sent back by people who earn less than $50,000 a year and who spend 50% of their check to send back to relatives in Mexico. Who receives is the question. In Mexico, 18% of the adult population. Who receives? The majority are women. What impact? How many households? 4.4% of the household in Mexico, or 4.3 million people, receive these gifts. 40% of those receiving them depend on them to sustain themselves and not to slip into dire poverty. 3 to 4 people per household benefit from spending. And 73.6% of the recipients are under the age of 15 and over the age of 65. So what does this tells us? That as a family consultation strategy and method of survival, people decide which family migrates. And while the majority are men, 40% of those who do migrate are women. And they support brothers and sisters, not necessarily just parents. Yet when we look at who receives, and we see that the majority of the recipients are women, the decisions of how to use these $15 billion in the country of origin, in this case Mexico, are decisions of women. And they are decisions to sustain households. And what is the impact on these households? Without this gift from the people who have left, it would be impossible to sustain these families. They become the government welfare program without having the government involved. And without having the government involved, they go directly to the people in need, to those to whom it is critical to survive. And the fund keeps a large number of working class families from dropping into poverty, and the elderly and the children particularly taken care of. Families that receive these gifts are more likely to send children to schools, have access to health care, and likely to start a small business. The funds, as said, tend to be directed toward the caring, the giving of that family unity, the children. The function of the mother model of the economy that Genevieve put forward in her theory. But in this case, acting as a family unit. Then you have collective gift giving. Collective gift giving is the coming together of communities who are, for instance, in the case of Mexico and the United States, into what are called clubes, clubs of the originating city where they are from. Some people call them hometown associations. They have existed with other migrant groups. There are hometown associations for Jewish immigrants, for Irish immigrants, for the immigrant experience in general. In the case of Mexico, these constitute probably the people who send the remittances that according to many sources now say, are really not taken into account by any financial institution, because these gifts are not transferred through banks, but are taken by communities directly through the clubes and their representatives. These tend to be immigrants who have settled longer within the United States, but who sustain a large number of new immigrants every year. The clubes, or hometown associations, are volunteer, structurally organized collective entities that consult with the community where they're from to decide on how to spend time in terms of projects and mutual obligations to the well-being of the town. Some of these are in response to crises, such as a natural disaster, but others are a continual and developed interchange between the hometown and the hometown association in the United States, or the clubes. And what do? Well, they collect money through simple activities such as rodeos and bake sales and very grassroots type of activities. And they both invest in the community, but they also send goods. There's a transfer of certain goods that they will buy in the United States and then transfer to the countries, to the communities. Things such as ambulances, medical equipment, school buses and supplies, machinery for the development of the town well, equipment that may lead to the construction of a particular hospital. They invest in social projects, scholarships for people in the town, health clinics, child care facilities, home for the elderly. And they even invest in job creations, some vocational schools to permit the youth to have skills to be able to operate in the economy. How many of these are there? We really don't know. There's a calculation. There are probably 630 U.S. cities, 218 in L.A. alone. They also form state federations. Some of the strongest are the La Federación del Sur, de Clubes del Sur de California, the Federation of Clubs of Southern California. There's the Federation of Clubes of the State of Michoacán. And there's the Federation of Clubes de Jalisco of different state, of states. And how do they collect the resources and the monies to be able to invest in the towns? It's through membership dues. It's through quotas. It's through fundraising activities, donations, and sometimes in the case of the oldest and strongest, like the Federación de Clubes del Sur de California, they even enter into arrangements with local and state governments. Some of them have even entered into arrangements with the NAT Bank in order to create pools of resources to increase their communities. I'll give you some examples. The Federation of Clubes de Zacatecas in 1995 convinced the governor of the state that if they invested $1, the municipal government should invest $1 and the state government should invest in another dollar. And so was created the program known as Dos por Uno, two for one. And so among the federation clubs, they gathered $600,000. And they took to Zacatecas with the investment of municipal and state governments, were able to fund 56 projects in 34 towns. Four of hometown associations of the state of Michoacán and Illinois raised $650,000 for projects in their localities about the same time as well. But then you have concrete examples of the individual clubs. There are 100 families in Anaheim, California. They have a club called El Club Tamastitian. And they basically organize around health projects for the town because there is a sanctuary in the town called El Señor de los Reyes. And many people throughout Mexico come to be healed. And what the town people observed was that as these people came to be healed by the spiritual healing of El Señor de los Reyes, they would enter into health crises, and there was no infrastructure. to take care of the sick. And so they've invested in building a house so that medical schools around Mexico can send student doctors to practice and train in the town. They bought surgical equipment, and they've installed a water pump to assist the clinics of the area. You have another example, like Club Pesqueros, who basically, one of the persons there died because there was no ambulance. And so families of Pesqueros, Jalisco, joined together and bought the ambulance. Now they have a fund to support, to give scholarships for middle and high school students. Again, a strategy to prevent dropouts. And support 57 children with developmental problems. And every year, one of their fundraising activities here in the States is to have a banquet, a baile, and a rodeo. And there is a reina of the Club Pesqueros, a queen of the Club Pesqueros. But this is the young woman, not the most beautiful young woman, but the one that can raise the most funds to go to the collective fund for the work in the town. So after hearing all the discussions here, I was thinking of suggesting to the Club Pesquero, they call her the goddess of gift giving. And so these examples are examples then of community. The poorest of the poor on the international global scale, the most exploited, the women you see cleaning our rooms, the people cutting our lawns, the people working in the restaurants, these are the ones who are gift-giving of their, despite the conditions of exploitation. What are the impacts? Well, there are within many spheres that say, well, these are not good investments. It might be $15 billion, but it's not a good way of investing. Why? Because they don't invest in productive projects. They don't invest in capital-making projects. They simply support families. And so it's a very interesting discussion because it goes to the heart of some of the theories put forth in the gift economy of how the sustaining of families to develop and the sustaining of communities, like the infrastructure projects that many of these clubes have undertaken, are not considered a valuable, from the capitalist point of view, a valuable form of gift-giving to the community. And so suddenly one day I was reading and I saw a paper by John B. Taylor, the Undersecretary of Treasury for International Affairs, at the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, give a presentation, and he states, "In my remarks, I would like to discuss, number one, why Bush administration cares so much about remittances. Why the Bush administration cares so much about remittances. That is, as people, as the capitalist financial establishment and corporations begin to understand the volume of gift giving being sent back by individuals and communities, the question then became, how do we take advantage of it? How does this gift giving contribute to our own interests and developments? And so now the Federal Reserve Bank needs to figure out how to get easy wire transfers between immigrant communities and countries of origin. Immigrant communities faced with increasing ability to move because of tougher border enforcement measures and the lack of programs to legalize their status, find it much more difficult to move what was once transfers done by family members and persons back to the communities. So the financial institutions are positioning themselves to see which can offer the better program and at the same time charge for the transfer of these. It is considered that even a 1% cost of transfers or a lowering of cost of transfers that is now in many cases done by Western Union or MoneyGram could actually contribute one more $1 billion to sustain families in the countries of origin. There's the other interest by governments, the Fox administration particularly. It's interesting how he has created this concept of congratulating the people in the United States for what now has become the largest source of foreign exchange to Mexico, beyond petroleum, beyond tourism. And again, like in other countries, has edged the net direct capitalist contribution in foreign investment in Mexico. The Fox administration has developed several government programs so that these funds are invested in productive projects, which again mean profit-making projects. There was one of his administration people who in a public speech said, our economy is doing great. We have had so much success in oil, in trade, and by the way, in remittances sent by the paisanos, as if they had anything to do with the earning of these in the country of origin and then the sending back. But certainly it is, they are being seen by the capitalist establishment as a mine goal that had become and was invisible as the gift giving should be, and only recognized by those that received it and the communities who basically had the experience of the projects that were brought forth by the many clubes that exist in the United States. And so that brought the practice, this is the practice, the movement of people, the sending of money, that has an impact. The very small ant-like savings have a tremendous aggregate effect upon the economies that are being sent. It is interesting to me to note that when studies have been done with the sophisticated analysis that economists can now do of what is called matrices of I don't know what things that economists do, that there have been a certain analysis that even those micro gifts that become aggregate sums have a tremendous impact on the well-being of the economy, such as the Mexican economy. For instance, in a study done by one of those economists, showed that just the injection of $2 billion as a result of remittances increased the output of production in Mexico by $4 billion. And increased income in Mexico to approximately 2.2% of total income, with the results of the creation of 325,225 potential jobs. In other words, there can be one job created for every $4,400 of the money sent back home by immigrants. So there is a definite impact on economies and the well-being, and the capitalist ready now to capitalize. So when I look at the issue of gift giving and where progressive movements are in their theoretical development of such experiences, what we see is that while we can conceptualize that the experience of gift giving comes from homes that send, come from decisions of consensus, come from decisions in which men and women decide who migrates and who makes the decisions of how to invest when that money is seen. They can have those values, which are the values of mothering, nurturing, and giving, are meaningless unless they're infused with the experience of those who are exploited and oppressed. Because that gives us the direction. It is the difference between the mothering and the nurturing described by the cardinal in Rome that characterizes women, and the nurturing and caring that is being done by immigrants all over the world to their families and their commission, which is a direct result of the experience of exploitation and oppression. And how to resist, how to construct communities, how to really live in the practical terms, a globalization from below.